It's 9 a.m. and you're listening to 88.5 WHBK-FM Chicago, the pride of the South Side. Talk Chicago is now on the air. This is John Zaglul, and I'll be your host for the next hour. Today, we have an action-packed show ahead for you, as we'll be recapping yesterday's Bears game. A great win, but did Cody Parkey kick his way out of his own job with Chicago? We'll analyze that coming up here in just a moment. Later on, we'll talk about the Chicago Blackhawks and the firing of Joel Quenneville. What does that mean for the organization, and was the firing justified? Did Quenneville deserve the punishment that he received? At 9:30, we'll be talking with Tom Verducci on MLB Network and of Sports Illustrated. He'll be calling in. We'll talk with him about the MLB awards races. Those are going to be starting up this week. Tonight, Rookie of the Year will be announced for both the AL and the NL. Then Cy Young, MVP, Manager of the Year. So a very interesting and very busy week for Major League Baseball, even though they're not in season. And then after Tom Verducci, I'll give my predictions on who I think is going to win all of those awards. And just to give you a reminder, last year I was 8-for-8 on all of those picks. So I hope to continue that legacy this week. But anyway, so glad you're joining us this morning on WHPK. Before we get started, let's take care of a little housekeeping. You're listening to 88.5 WHPK-FM Chicago. You can reach me personally on Twitter at John Z Sports, Instagram at John Zags, and Facebook at John Zaglul. And remember, if you'd like to watch and take a look at what's going on right here in the booth, you can go on Facebook and watch my Facebook live stream of today's show. All music today is produced and performed by TMMRW, and he's on all music platforms, including Spotify and iTunes. And his first concert is coming up. He's going to be opening for Black the day after Thanksgiving at the Riviera Theater in Chicago. So if you want some tickets to that, make sure to find those online. It's also listed in his Spotify profile. Now, if you want to contribute to today's conversation, whether it be about the Bears and Cody Parkey's problems, about the Blackhawks and the firing of Joel Quenneville, or about the MLB awards races, which, by the way, includes Javier Baez in the conversation, you give me a call, 773-702-8424. Again, that's 773-702-8424. So let's get started today talking about the Chicago Bears, with Khalil Mack back in action, along with the Lions defense that somehow forgot how to cover a wide receiver. The Bears yesterday cruised to a 34-22 victory, moved up to 6-3 in the division, and strengthened their NFC North divisional lead. Now, what stood out to me yesterday, I know Cody Parkey's problems were inherent, and we'll get to that coming up later, but let's point out the good things that happened yesterday first, because a lot of guys who you didn't expect to do well did very well and exceeded expectations. The Bears defense continued their dominance, and I knew they were going to do well, of course, but they did well or better than anyone had expected, especially against Matt Stafford, a guy who had a QB rating entering the game at 96.2, and that plummeted after yesterday's performance. The Bears forced 3 turnovers yesterday. That gives them 24 in the season. And how interesting is this? The Bears, all of last year, had 22 takeaways. Already this season, they have 24 through 9 games, and they lead the NFL in that category. An impressive performance yesterday and all season by the Bears. And that also equates to victories, because now they've got a plus 13 turnover differential. When that stat is positive, It's indicative of not only a winning record, but a playoff-worthy team. The Bears, with that stat, they're second in all of football behind the Cleveland Browns. And I know the Browns aren't necessarily a playoff-worthy team, but if they had had a kicker and if they had started Baker Mayfield earlier, they sure as heck could have been. But other teams around the Bears in that turnover differential stat include the Seahawks, the Redskins, who lead the NFC East, the Rams, obviously a very good team, the Chargers, and the Panthers. All of those teams are today in the playoff conversation. So when you have a plus, when you have a positive turnover differential, good things are bound to happen, and that's what's been going on for the Bears thus far. A special welcome back yesterday to Khalil Mack. Sat out for two games due to an injury, two games that weren't necessarily important. The Bears won both of them, but Mack yesterday, he came back with a vengeance. Man, two sacks, four tackles. He now has seven sacks on the season in seven games, averaging one sack a game. Without a doubt, I will be extremely disappointed if Khalil Mack is not a Pro Bowler by season's end. I mean, my goodness, what a specimen on the field. And every single time that Mack does well, it makes you wonder what John Gruden was thinking back when he traded him. It seems like every week we're talking about Khalil Mack and how well he's done, and every week John Gruden just looks worse and worse as the Raiders head coach. I think it's kind of funny. Quietly yesterday too, which I think, I don't know, it seems like Khalil Mack, yes, he's anchoring this defense, but everyone's forgetting about how well Roquan Smith has been doing. Smith yesterday recorded the second sack of his career. He had eight tackles. And on the season, he has 63 total tackles. That's a top 20 statistic in the NFL. And everyone forgets about that because, number one, Khalil Mack's on the team. And number two, everyone forgets that Roquan Smith didn't even participate in training camp. I mean, these first seven or eight games are technically his training camp. He's only going to get better. But being a top 20 defensive player in the NFL based on tackles for a guy who held out all of training camp, that's unbelievably impressive. And that's a testament to Roquan Smith and his true talent. Because if you're able to do all of that without even training camp under your belt, you are a talented football player. And I'm looking forward to seeing how he'll progress now in the second half of this season down the stretch when the Bears are going to rely on him the most. Now, on the offensive side of things, Mitchell Trubisky broke out in a big way, albeit against a mediocre defense. But despite that fact, Trubisky did great. 23 of 30, 355 yards, four total touchdowns, because he had the three passing touchdowns, the one rushing touchdown. And Trubisky against that kind of defense, he needs to do well, right? He should do well. I mean, you saw yesterday what had happened where, you know, the Lions, I mean, they left guys wide open. I mean, Allen Robinson was open many times. They were breaking down in coverage in the secondary. They weren't switching the right way. They had their safeties miss coverages. Anthony Miller caught that touchdown. He was wide open at the 10-yard line. He scampered right in untouched. So a horrific defense, a horrendous defense by the Detroit Lions. So that does contribute to Trubisky's success, but at the same time, you know, in Trubisky's case, you have to do well against a defense like that. You know, last week we talked about his problems against the Bills. The Bills aren't a great team. Trubisky didn't do well. Yesterday, in a game in which he should have done well, he did do well. And that's the important thing, the important takeaway about Trubisky's performance yesterday. Maybe it was an easy team. Maybe the defense was very easy to pick apart, but nevertheless, you still have to complete a pass. You still have to find open guys and score touchdowns, and Trubisky did all of that yesterday. I have nothing bad to say about him. He did very well, performed very well. I mean, this was arguably the best performance of his career considering the defense he faced. I mean, sure, you could argue that the Buccaneers game was great, but that defense was unbelievably horrible. I mean, the worst in the NFL. The Lions are at least a bit better in that respect. And considering that this was a divisional game, a game the Bears needed to win, I feel like yesterday could have been Trubisky's best performance of the season. Now, I think, however, that despite Trubisky's performance, despite the elite defensive attack and despite even the poor Lions defense yesterday, there was a different story to the game. All of those things were great. Everybody did well. There were things to cheer about, but there was one story that supersedes all of that great stuff that happened yesterday. And it was the fact that Cody Parkey, whom the Bears just signed to a 4-year deal before the season, missed 2 field goals and then missed 2 extra points in the game. Look, if you want to be a playoff contending team, if you want a Super Bowl championship, in the end, you need an effective kicker. And I can't believe that I have to sit here and talk about this right now, but it's the truth. When you have a guy who's clanking field goals off both of the uprights, you know, you're not going to be winning lots of games. And I know the Bears are 6-3, and I know yesterday that the kicking situation didn't result in them losing the game, which is obviously a good thing. But I'll tell you what, if that continues later in the year when the Bears are going to have to face the Packers again, the Vikings starting this upcoming Sunday night, and again later in the year, the Rams coming up, if you have Cody Parkey missing a 40-yard field goal, you're not going to win football games, plain and simple. And a great parallel to this saga is the Cleveland Browns. Cleveland Browns right now, 3-6-1. And you may think, oh yeah, that's because, you know, they're dysfunctional, they don't have a coach. You can make all the arguments you want. But in week one, they tied. They lost in week two. And they lost in week four. All of those weeks, they went 0-2-1 in those 3 weeks because they didn't have an effective kicker who could kick in a field goal from 40 yards out. And that's the truth. You can go look online. You can ask Cleveland Brown fans. You can ask national media people. And that's the truth. Hugh Jackson could still have a job right now if the Browns had been able to make some kicks in those first 4 weeks. The Browns could be a playoff contender, for God's sake. But because of their kicking dysfunction, they can't be now. And I'm worried that that could happen to the Bears at this point. Because they have a great defense. Trubisky's starting to turn it on. They need their run game to pick up a bit, but it's not like that's been detrimental to their cause. But if they can't make a 40-yard field goal, man, I mean, come on now. How are you supposed to win a game when you can't make a field goal? Very scary, scary sentiment. And the fact that Cody Parkey is getting paid $9 million to make a field goal makes it even worse. You're supposed to be making 40, 45, even 50-yard field goals if need be. And when you're missing those, when you're missing chip shots in games that matter, I mean, you're out of luck at that point. And I can't believe that the Bears aren't at least going to entertain the idea of trying out some kickers. This situation has got to be nipped in the bud right away, no questions asked. You can't sit here and give Parkey more chances and go back and forth with him because eventually you're going to run out of time, there's going to be no one left on the market, and when you need a kick to go in, let's say in week 17 or in the playoffs, if the Bears make it that far, and it doesn't happen, you're going to be blamed for it. The Bears have a chance right now to correct this problem before it gets any worse, before it starts costing them games. And if they don't, they're going to be in for a very rude awakening come later in the season. Now, next week, the Bears are going to face the Vikings on Sunday Night Football. Very competitive game. The Vikings right now, second in the division, a 5-3-1 record. The Bears 6-3. So whoever loses that game, if it's the Bears, they will lose their division lead. So a pivotal game next week on Sunday Night Football. They have to control, there are two things, really. First of all, they have to control Kirk Cousins next week. Cousins has been doing well. He's been padding his stats more so. I mean, he is a good quarterback. Has he been one of the best in the game this year? No, but he's been doing good. Better than Matthew Stafford, that's for sure. So the Bears have to find a way to control him. And then the Vikings have a very good run game. Dalvin Cook, second year in the league. He's doing great. The Bears have to find a way to control him. And that's the moral of the story next week. They've got Kirk Cousins and Dalvin Cook to control. If they do that, they should be able to pull out a win. But if they let the Minnesota defense, or the Minnesota offense rather, run all over them, if they let Kirk Cousins get time in the pocket to pass, it's going to be a problem for the Bears next week. Either way, though, a good win by the Bears. And coming into this coming week, a 6-3 record, I feel like they're in a very good position. They just got to make sure they correct that kicking problem before it comes back to haunt them later in the year. Poaching is a major threat to our country's wildlife. The Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust works with private landowners to protect wildlife, preserve natural habitats, and create permanent sanctuaries. To learn more, call 1-800-729-SAVE, 1-800-729-SAVE, or visit wildlifelandtrust.org. So we just finished up talking about the Bears and their big win yesterday. Talked about Cody Parkey's problems, too. If you have anything to contribute, if you have any thoughts on the Bears game, or if you have any thoughts on what we're going to talk about next involving the Blackhawks, feel free to do so. Give me a call, 773-702-8424. 773-702-8424. So let's move on now from the Bears and talk about the Chicago Blackhawks. So I have a question for you folks at home to start this segment. When you think about the Chicago Blackhawks as an organization, what comes to mind? What comes to mind when I say Chicago Blackhawks? If I asked this question 20 years ago, you would have immediately started laughing, because at the time, the Hawks had no significance, they had no clout. They were a team that hadn't won a Stanley Cup since 1961. And from 1998 through 2008, they only qualified for the playoffs once. So the Hawks, in that period of time, were mediocre. And if I asked you 20 years ago what you thought of the Blackhawks, you would have started cracking up and laughing, saying, I can't believe you watched that sorry excuse for a team. But today, when I ask this question, when I ask you what you think about the Blackhawks as an organization, none of those past failures come to mind. Instead, you're probably thinking of the 3 Stanley Cups in 6 years, their 9 straight playoff appearances from 09 to 17. They've been a very good team over that time. Now, why is that the case? Now, sure, you've had some great players like Patrick Kane, Jonathan Toews, anchoring this team, but what about the coach? Who's led them this far? Who's led them to 797 wins over 10 years? Who led them to 3 Stanley Cups in 6 years? That's right. It was Joel Quenneville. How do you like that, huh? Joel Quenneville led the team to the 3 Stanley Cups. Joel Quenneville led the team to 797 wins. Joel Quenneville led the team to 9 straight playoff appearances. That's unprecedented. The Hawks had never had that kind of success in their entire franchise history. They were the laughingstocks of the NHL for decades, for generations. And Joel Quenneville comes in, turns around the franchise like that, and in a period of 8 or 9 years, leads them to success beyond their wildest dreams. But last Tuesday, the Hawks decided, and they thought it was in their best interest, to let Joel Quenneville go. They fired him. After a run of success that no other coach in franchise history had ever achieved and will ever achieve, Joel Quenneville was rewarded for that by being fired. And I have to say, the Chicago Blackhawks, they've now solidified themselves as one of the NHL's most pathetic organizations today. I am struggling to understand why Joel Quenneville is being blamed for the Hawks' struggles. He's had to operate without a goalie for nearly 1.5 years. Corey Crawford has been hurt, and they've had to use a rotation of different guys. When you don't have a goalie in the NHL, you don't have a team. The goalie is the glue to your team. So Quenneville's had no goalie. The front office has continually gotten rid of good talent over the years. We remember Brandon Saad's first trade, Nicholas Chalmers' trade, Brian Campbell, Dustin Byfuglien. I could go on and on about the names that the Hawks have given away for nothing. No reason. They just can't. They can't or they don't want to pay them, so they ship them off. How are you supposed to win with the team when every year key guys, key cogs on your team are being sold away, traded away? No reason behind it. In fact, I can argue that Quenneville's success is actually more impressive considering the amount of work he's needed to do every year in order to overcome the horrendous decisions made by the front office. As Joel Quenneville's, or in Joel Quenneville's case, I feel for you, man. And I've had it with the Hawks, that's it. From this point forward, without Q heading the ship, this team is bound for a collapse of mass proportions. And today, no matter the talent, no matter the improvements made, without Coach Quenneville, this team is unwatchable. End of story. That's it. I mean, how do you fire a guy who has been the most successful coach in franchise history, who's broken an NHL Stanley Cup drought, who's led you to 3 Stanley Cups in 6 years, who's led you to 9 straight playoff appearances, and who's won you nearly 800 games? And all of a sudden, you just decide to cut ties with him. Why don't you look at yourself in the mirror, Stan Bowman? Why don't you look at yourself in the mirror, Rocky Wirtz, and think about what you've done to help this team out? Instead of blaming it on the best coach in franchise history and one of the best coaches in the NHL, period. The Hawks need to understand that this was not Quenneville's fault. They need to realize that this is out of Quenneville's control. This has nothing to do with Quenneville being a good or bad coach. This has nothing to do with Quenneville playing certain players over others or shifting up the rotation in the first, second, and third lines. This has nothing to do with that. Joel Quenneville's done amazing. He's done everything that he could possibly do, and he's gotten the most out of every player that he's coached here in Chicago throughout his tenure. I mean, he's made guys become superstars. He's made guys who have had no name, who were destined to have nothing, become very good, become respected players in the NHL. Chalmerson's a great example. Byfuglien, too. Brian Campbell. All of those guys were never household names. They were never going to amount to much, yet Quenneville got so much out of them that they were actually recognizable names, and they're actually quality players in today's NHL. But instead of recognizing that, instead of realizing how well he's coached his team, and instead of realizing how well the team has done, more importantly, over his tenure, the Hawks just decided, you know what, yeah, we're good. I know you're one of our best coaches in franchise history, but we don't need you anymore. What kind of logic is that? Getting rid of the best coach in franchise history just because you feel like it, because the team started off 6-6. They had chances, too, on top of it, to turn things around. I felt like Quenneville could have turned this team around come later in the year and come even playoff time. I mean, a 6-6 start is not bad. It's not like they're the Cavaliers starting off 1-11 and changing their head coach. That I understand. If you start 1-11, yes, there probably is a head coaching problem. But when you start 500, when you start 6-6, when you have the track record and respect around the league that John Quenneville has, it makes no sense to me that he ended up getting fired. Shame on the Blackhawks for making this move. And kudos to Joel Quenneville on one heck of a run here in Chicago. Every day, children are sexually solicited online. Don't believe the type. Visit cybertipline.com for information on how to protect yourself from the threat of online predators. This was brought to you by the Ad Council. So we just finished up talking about Joel Quenneville and his tragic firing from the Blackhawks. We also talked about the Bears, recapped their game yesterday, talked about Cody Parkey's problems. If you have anything to contribute to the conversation, give me a call, 773-702-8424. 773-702-8424. So it's now time for the Sports Talk Chicago Flashback. Each week, we'll play a newsworthy clip from one of my recent podcasts. And back in the spring, I had the great opportunity to talk with Michael Vick, former NFL Pro Bowl quarterback and human cheat code. In these next few minutes, you'll hear about the story behind that infamous Monday Night Football game. And believe it or not, that game involved Michael Vick hearing about Donovan McNabb's contract extension, and it motivated him to do well. And you'll hear that in the clip. You'll also hear about his rapid rise to fame and how he handled it all. And near the end of the interview, I asked Vick about his time in prison and how he was able to overcome that obstacle to continue his legendary career. It's quite moving, this interview, so I'm really happy I'm able to play it for you today. Now, when we come back from the interview, Tom Verducci of MLB Network and Sports Illustrated will be joining us by phone. We'll be breaking down all of the award races in Major League Baseball, and then later after that, I'll give my picks for the awards. So still much more to come here on Sports Talk Chicago today, but right now, here's my candid conversation with Michael Vick. This is 88.5 WHBK-FM Chicago. Take a look back at your illustrious football career. I mean, the numbers you put up, you know, being a dual threat, being a runner and passer, were amazing. So what was your secret to success? Because, you know, there are a lot of quarterbacks today who are frowned upon for being, you know, running quarterbacks, like Lamar Jackson, for example. But your career really serves as an exception to that rule. So how'd you do it?
It's a credit to my coaches. Dan Reeves, for example, he really put together game plans that allowed me to show my talent. And if it was running the football on quarterback draws, the design run quarterback draws that he put together, just quarterback rollouts with great blocking schemes, allowed me to be myself and let the talents that I had show. And I guess he looked at it as, why have a mobile quarterback and not use him? So he was able to go into his offensive playbook and tweak some things and put me in a position to help the team win. I was getting first downs, keeping chains moving, and helping the team win games week in and week out at an early age. So as well as, you know, Greg Knapp on numerous occasions the year I ran 4,000 yards. And then when I got to Andy allowed me to use those talents as well.
You know, speaking of Andy Reid and your time with the Eagles, you know, I had to ask this question. I remember Monday Night Football, you were signed by the Eagles, you became the starting quarterback, and that infamous game against the Washington Redskins, you threw for 333 yards and four touchdowns. I think after that game, everyone was like, you know what, Michael Vick is back. What contributed to your success that night? And, you know, take me through what happened, because that was just an amazing game to watch, so electrifying and so entertaining.
It was just being motivated. I think, you know, before the game, Donovan McNabb had been awarded a big contract. And, you know, sometimes as competitors, you want to be, you know, along the lines of the greats in the same lineage. And, you know, I felt as if I was to go out that night and showcase my talents on the national stage, it would show that in years to come I could be, you know, elite quarterback, premier quarterback in the league and get paid top dollar amongst the best. And just having that happen right before the game, maybe 3 hours before, really just fueled my fire. And when I went into the game, I was calm. Money wasn't on my mind. It was all about being successful on the field and making the guys around me better, and at the end of the day, winning the game.
Speaking of your career, I wanted to go back to the time in which you were drafted. You were drafted first overall by the Atlanta Falcons. So with that in mind, first, you know, what was it like to be drafted so high, being the number one selection? And also, what did it mean to you to be the first African-American quarterback to be drafted first overall?
Well, it was great. And, you know, as far as, you know, my lack of knowledge in that situation, you know, I wasn't aware that I was going to be the first African-American quarterback selected. It wasn't until after it happened, because you got to wait till things happen, and I was able to embrace that. And I know the draft is a tricky process, but that was a great accomplishment within its own right. And, you know, I felt like, you know, that opened doors and just paved the way for guys, you know, behind me and guys to come. And that night, it was a night I'll never forget. You know, you work your whole life, you know, to walk across that stage and meet the commissioner, shake his hand and turn and face the crowd and smile and you know, thank God that you've arrived. And, you know, it's just a real moment, and it's, you only get to live it one time. And I'm just glad I was a guy who can share those memories with people, you know, like you and people around the world who ask the same question and want some insight on it. It's an unbelievable experience. And, you know, for the young kids right now dreaming, you know, it's a great dream to dream, and it can be accomplished.
So I wanted to go to 2007 and at the height of your career. Now, you pleaded guilty to federal charges involving a dogfighting investigation and served 18 months in prison. So what I wanted to ask you is, you know, what was that time like for you, and what life lessons did you learn, and how did you overcome that experience to come? So that was my interview with Michael Vick. Really great guy. So happy that he took the time to come on the show, back on the podcast. And, you know, some great stories that he mentioned, great stories that he exchanged about his career, and especially the motivation behind that Monday night game. Quite moving, quite interesting, and so happy that he came and joined me back in the spring of my podcast. Well, as promised, it's now time for our special guest. He began his sports journalism career in 1982 with Florida Today, and after a 10-year stint at Newsday in New York, he became a senior writer with Sports Illustrated in 1993, covering Major League Baseball. Now today, in addition to his time at SI, he's an insider on MLB Network, a broadcaster for Fox Sports, and a member of the Baseball Writers Association of America. Please welcome Tom Verducic to the show. Tom, how are you doing today? And thank you for getting up and being here on the show this morning.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, Tom, to start today, I know that this is the beginning of the awards week here in Major League Baseball, and there's lots of speculation as to who will end up winning some very important hardware. Now, as a BBWAA member, you do have some influence over the upcoming results. So beginning with the AL MVP race, who do you think is most deserving of that award?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think a lot of these races seem to be wide open in August, and people like to start speculating who's going to win before the movie ends, so to speak. But I think it's going to be a pretty easy win for Mookie Betts. I think he was the best player in the league. He played on the best team in the league. And I think he's going to win because of his all-around game. Of course, the other finalists are Mike Trout and Jose Ramirez, a lot of those same qualities, but you know, Mookie's numbers are just above those guys, and I think the fact that he's a 30-30 guy who also is a batting champion, the first time we've ever seen that in baseball history, is kind of one of those superlatives that, in a nutshell, makes him the best player in the league. So I actually think it's not going to be all that close.
Now, does it bother you, though, about Mookie Betts that he missed some time due to injury? I mean, he did play in 136 games. How do you think the voters will reflect that?
Yeah, you know, I think in today's game, it's not that big of a deal. I mean, it seems like guys are not playing 162 or even getting up to 155 or thereabouts. It happens less than it does. But, you know, I do think based on his overall numbers, you know, the volume of work is still there. And I think there have been past years, whether it was Joe Mauer or I think Josh Hamilton 1 year missed a month and still won the award. You know, listen, I think if the numbers were a little bit closer, the guy with the greater volume is going to win. But, you know, there's so much attention now paid to rate stats, and especially with WAR, and because of Mookie's base running and his defense, I think he made up for the fact that he did miss those 3 weeks.
Tom Verducci here on Sports Talk Chicago. And Tom, going to the NL MVP race, there is some Chicago significance as Javier Baez was named a finalist in the race, opposing Christian Yelich and Nolan Arenado. Now, I know he's had some trouble getting on base. His OPS is under 900. It's the lowest amongst the two finalists. Where do you see Baez placing in this race?
Yeah, it's an interesting argument because on sheer numbers, I think Yelich is your winner. And I do think he's going to win. But I think when you look at Javi's contributions to the team winning, it's almost, and I know we have numbers for everything, but it's almost harder to ascribe a certain number to what he did. For instance, there's never been an MVP who started games at both shortstop and second base. And Javi did that, obviously. He also played some third base. Basically, whatever the team needed, if there was an injury or a need at a certain position, Javi could go there and play it at a Gold Glove caliber rate. And, you know, I'm not sure exactly how you quantify something like that, but I know if you're Joe Maddon, you're a manager, you love to have that kind of a chess piece to move around that, you know, he can pick up a hole and play a position at any time in the middle of a season and do it at a really high level. You mentioned the on-base percentage. To me, that's what's going to keep Javi from winning this award. It'd be very difficult. I mean, very few guys with on-base percentages that low have won the MVP award. And I think when you look at Yelich, what he did also down the stretch is something that we see a lot of times. Guys can put the award away with a big September. I think of Chipper Jones in 99 doing that. That, you know, what you do down the stretch, you can argue that every game is just as important in April as it is in September. But the fact is, as the games start to run out, those games do become more important. And I think as a last impression for voters as well, you know, when you've got that ballot in your hand at the end of the season, what's freshest in your mind? In this case, it was Christian Yelich just basically going all Barry Bonds on baseball in this last month or two of the season. So, again, I think it's a case where during the season, a lot of discussion, a lot of the good debate, healthy debate, who's the MVP. Bottom line is I think neither one of these votes are going to be that close.
Let's stay in the NL now and go to the Cy Young Award race. And it seems as if Jacob deGrom has been and will be the consensus favorite before the awards unveiling on Wednesday. Is that a fair assessment, or can you see a legitimate case to be made for Scherzer and Nola?
Well, listen, I think you'd make a case for Max Scherzer. I think he'll get a few first-place votes, but make no mistake, this is Jacob deGrom's award. And you know, I think we've advanced to the point where we understand that, you know, wins have a lot of different factors to it beyond the control of the pitcher. But in what the pitcher can control, when you look at all the numbers, especially the ERA, and I know that's not the be-all and the end-all, but the fact is, with it's such a big gap exists, you know, a half run or more in this case with the other finalists. That's too much for me for another guy to overcome, even if the other pitcher has more strikeouts or more wins. So I think you may see Scherzer get a few, maybe a handful of first-place votes, no more than that. But I know people are going to make a big deal of the fact that Jacob deGrom doesn't have a lot of wins. He'll have the fewest of any starting pitcher to win the award. But that's just kind of an anomaly in terms of the run support that he got, the team that he pitched on. His other numbers across the board, you know, are right there with some of Clayton Kershaw's best seasons. So if you just covered up the one loss total, there'd be no doubt who the Cy Young Award winner is. And I think you'll see that in the final vote. I don't think it's going to be unanimous, but it's going to be pretty darn close to that.
You know, being a BBWAA member, I know you know, some of your colleagues are more so old school, and they'll probably look at that 10-9 record. How do you think that's going to factor into DeGrom's vote total? Do you think that there are people within the BBWAA who still feel that wins are important and will penalize DeGrom for having a 10-9 record?
I think so. As you mentioned, alluded to, I think there are fewer of those type of voters, but it wouldn't shock me if there's a couple of them. It wouldn't surprise me if, say, because each city in the National League, in this case, would be represented with two BBWAA voters. It wouldn't surprise me if the Washington votes go to Scherzer. Those guys get to see Max make all of his starts. And not to say you're partial to the team they cover, but it's kind of a human bias here that the one you're most familiar with, you know, you've seen this guy on his best days multiple times in this case. So it wouldn't surprise me if you say, you know, two votes in Washington go to Scherzer. Maybe there's another vote because of what you mentioned in terms of the win total that goes to Scherzer. But I think those days of guys who start with the one loss total and move on from there, I think those, if not done, they're certainly extinct.
Going now back to the American League, the Cy Young race there includes Blake Snell as a favorite to win, despite pitching in less than 181 innings. And if he does win, he'd set the record for the lowest amount of innings pitched by a starting pitcher who ends up winning the award. What are your thoughts on that? And then what are your thoughts on how that will affect Snell's candidacy?
Yeah, you know, I don't have a big problem with that. I mean, I would say as long as the pitcher is qualified, the 162 innings to me is sort of the minimum for me. But the fact is, his other numbers are just terrific. And I think he's the best pitcher in the American League. I expect he's going to win the award. I do agree, though, that may hold back some people. A lot of people looking at volume. And, you know, I think as we look more and more at rate stats, we have de-emphasized volume too much. But in this case, I think he did pitch enough. I think if Chris Sale had remained healthy in August and September, you could say this for a second year in a row, I think, he probably would have won the award. But again, he didn't wind up with nearly the same kind of volume as you'd like to see. But I think when you look at the strikeout numbers, certainly the whip for Snell, the ERA, I've got him as my Cy Young. It'll be an interesting vote. I don't think it's a runaway, but I don't think it's going to be a coin flip either. I think he'll be a clear favorite when push comes to shove when this vote gets announced.
So shifting gears now to some free agency news and notes. It's been reported that the Chicago White Sox are interested in making a splash this offseason, i.e. looking into signing Bryce Harper or Manny Machado. From your perspective, how realistic is this idea?
I think it's very realistic. I think it's the right time and the right type of players for the White Sox to invest in. It's very rare when a player like those two gets on the free agent market. You're talking about two of the top 10 players in baseball at the age 26 season. So as a team like the White Sox, and I'll put the Phillies in this category as well, a little bit of the Minnesota Twins, younger teams with payroll room that now are growing into a window where they should contend, to me, it's the right time. I mean, if it was 2 or 3 years ago, maybe not for the White Sox, maybe not for the Phillies. But I do think for teams, especially like the White Sox and the Phillies, they have to get involved here, see where the bidding goes. I'm not saying it's a, you know, blow everybody out of the water, you know, get one of those guys at all costs. I mean, you know going in, it's going to be an expensive proposition. I think both players are at least $30 million a year. I think both players are at least a 10-year contract. So that, it's huge commitment to make. There's no question about it. But I think with the age of these two players, if you can ever feel good about extending someone for that length of time, this is the case. So, again, I think it makes all the sense in the world for the White Sox and the track that they're on to make that investment.
You know, I had your colleague Jason Stark on my podcast last week and asked him this question, and the minute I asked him it, he started to laugh, so I wanted to get your thoughts on it. So as a follow-up on Harper and Machado in general, now, are you expecting both guys to get a $350 to $400 million contract? And if so, do you think that they're worth that type of money?
Well, I think Harper will. I put it this way. You know, the record for the average annual value right now is a little over $34 million. That was Zach Greinke's contract. He's a 32-year-old pitcher when he signed that deal. And the other one is for the most money in a contract that went to Giancarlo Stanton, you know, about $325. He wasn't even a free agent. So Bryce Harper at 26, he's going to break either one of those records or both of those records. In other words, if he wants to go for the average annual value, you know, I could see him getting 35 times 8 or 10, you know. But if he wants the overall number, certainly you're looking at anywhere from 10 to 13 years for Bryce Harper, and maybe that average annual value goes down. But I do think, yes, as a free agent, and that's the key here, it's an open bidding war to add a player without giving up talent. You know, and as I said, these players rarely come on the market. So I do think he's going to set a financial record. Manny's a little more interesting because of his postseason last year. I think it did turn off some people because when you make someone like that your franchise player, you're making him not just for your fans and your regional sports network and everything publicity-wise as the key face. You're making him a guy that your young players are going to look up to and be around for years and years. So I think Manny may have cost him years in terms of commitment. I don't think he's going to cost himself too much in terms of the average annual value. But maybe his deal is more a 7 to 8 year deal than a 10 to 13 year deal. That's just my opinion. And as far as whether they're worth it or not, I would have to say yes, because the market will always determine your worth. And in this case, it is a free agent market. You know, it's not an extension. It's not a case of one team bidding on a player. This is a case of any team in baseball could get in here and decide how much these guys are worth. And that's why, you know, when I've seen great players, and these two are great players, when I see players get great players get on the market and have their prime years up for bidding, not just, you know, age 35 to 40, but their prime years, those guys get paid market value. And so I would say, yes, that's what they're worth in today's game. Now, if you want to get into a philosophical discussion of whether baseball players deserve this kind of money, you know, it is kind of crazy. There's no doubt about it. But based on the money that all of us spend and the time that we spend on baseball and consume baseball in so many different ways, the money is certainly there, and it should go to the greatest of players.
You know, thinking about the offseason, despite all of this talk surrounding Harper and Machado, there's always a move that flies under the radar and, you know, pays enormous dividends during the season. Do you see someone in your eyes who's being overlooked at the moment and could make an impact for a team in 2019?
Well, it's two pitchers that stand out for me in the trade market, and that's Corey Kluber and James Paxton. I mean, Kluber is under control for the next 3 years. He's you know, consistently for the last 4 or 5 years has pitched at a Cy Young level. You know, he can have an impact on a team the way that, say, Justin Verlander has for Houston the last year and a half. I don't think enough is being talked about that guy being available. He certainly is in Cleveland. Now, again, it's going to take a huge package to get him, but you know, that's a championship-changing type of pitcher in my book. If you have a contending team already and add an arm like Kluber, you know, again, my best comp would be Verlander. I think he can have that kind of an impact. And Paxton to a lesser degree, because he really hasn't been able to stay healthy through a full season, but in terms of a, you know, a young, left-handed, controllable pitcher who can dominate when he's healthy, those guys are certainly still valuable. I know the game has turned over a lot to relief pitching, but when starters like that become available to contending teams, they can change the balance of power. So I think in addition to the top of the free agent market, which is terrific this year, I think you're going to see some really interesting trades involving some really good pitchers.
And Tom, before we let you go here today, I read your piece on the World Series for Sports Illustrated, which was great, by the way, and I have to ask, how did you find out about the photographs in Alex Cora's office, and then what were the significance of those?
Yeah, well, it was one of the discussions or conferences I had with Alex before the World Series, and, you know, I was talking to him in his office, and you couldn't miss them, and I thought it was really a cool idea to take, you know, a photograph from every individual win the Red Sox had this year. And certainly they had a lot of them, 119 at the end of the season. It was visually, first of all, very striking. Your first thought is, man, that's a lot of wins, because it's essentially covering two entire walls in his office. But it was essentially about, you know, honoring the length of the season and everything that this team did. And for me, it made an impression on me, again, first of all, just the physical nature of seeing so many wins. But also the fact that when you look at the Red Sox team, I think you have to look at them beyond the scope of 2018. I think they did put them in the discussion among some of the best teams of all time. I think they're the best Red Sox team of all time, which is saying a lot. It's certainly been a lot of great Red Sox teams. And listen, I'm not going to put them in the top five, but maybe they're in a discussion for top 10 of all time when you think about how many wins that they have. And I know people will say, you know, with expanded postseason now, there's an opportunity to win more games. It's certainly true. But the fact is, that also means there's an opportunity for more losses. You know, since we went to the wild card format, the Red Sox are only the fourth team to post the most outright wins in baseball and go on and win the World Series. So there's a lot of trap doors in the postseason now. The Red Sox just blew through all of them. You think about the way that they rolled through teams like Houston and the Dodgers and the Yankees. The run that they had was very impressive. Not often when the best team in baseball plays their best baseball in October, and I think this Red Sox team did it. So congrats to Alex Cora. It'd be interesting to see if his name gets announced as the American League Manager of the Year. I tend to think it might be Bob Melvin. But I thought he did a terrific job, probably one of the best jobs I've ever seen from a first-year manager. This guy was made for that role. He paid his dues in other ways, such as being a bench coach with Houston, being the general manager of the Puerto Rico WBC team, certainly a great role player in the course of his career. Very smart baseball guy. It was a great team, but they had really great leadership as well.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for being here on the show today. Always a pleasure talking to you, and I really appreciate your insight this morning.
Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
That was Tom Verducci of MLB Network and Sports Illustrated. Really great time talking with him about his thoughts on the MLB awards race, and then also the idea, you know, about free agency, what the White Sox are going to do, what the Cubs are going to do, and some underrated signings coming up as well. Well, let's move on now. 88.5 WHBK FM Chicago. It's now time for our signature segment here on Sports Talk Chicago, called the Announcer's Call of the Day. Last week, former NFL Pro Bowl running back Chris Johnson announced his retirement from football, and his career was highlighted by his impressive 2009 season, which saw him rush for 2,000 yards, becoming one of seven players in NFL history to ever do it. In a game against Jacksonville that season, he broke free. He ran for 228 yards and two touchdowns. Now let's listen in to Gus Johnson on the call for CBS as Chris Johnson breaks free for a big touchdown run.
Third down and four for Vince Young at the 11. They're 2 of 9 on conversions. Here's the handoff to Chris Johnson. Johnson hurried away. Watch out! Johnson! Again! Puts it back! Touchdown, Tennessee! Woo! 89 yards! Watch, yet another missed tackle for Jacksonville right there. He just steps out of the tackle of Brian Russell and just, it's off to the races. And when you get
really great call there by Gus Johnson, one of my favorite announcers in football today. He does college football now for Fox. Such an electric voice, and another great run by Chris Johnson. And cheers to him on an amazing NFL career. Not necessarily a Hall of Fame running back, but there were a couple of years in which he was one of the best running backs in the NFL, no question. And that year, that play specifically shows exactly why. So, give us a call now. We've got about 10 minutes left here in the program today. 773-702-8424. We just got off the phone with Tom Verducci. He gave us his thoughts on the award races this year in Major League Baseball. And very quickly, for about the next 5-6 minutes, I'm going to give you my predictions. Last year, I was 8-for-8. So, I don't want to brag, but I was 8-for-8. I intend to do the same this year with my predictions. So let's start with the NL MVP. Now, although I would love to see Baez win the award, as Tom Verducci mentioned, his OPS and his on-base percentage are a bit too low. Christian Yelich, meanwhile, he led the NL in batting average at .326, led NL in positional player WAR, had an OPS of 1,000, and hit 36 home runs. When you have all of those statistics on your side, it's almost a no-brainer for you to win the award. He also led in total bases. He led in OPS plus. He had 110 RBIs and 118 runs scored. I mean, comparing him to Javier Baez statistically is foolish. I feel that Yelich is going to win that award. Going to the AL MVP race, sensically speaking, it will be Mookie Betts. He will win the award, but I don't agree with it. Betts only played in 136 games, and in my opinion, that's not enough to warrant consideration. He did take the league by storm. He had a 30-30 season. He hit .340. As Verducci mentioned, he's the first player to win a batting title and have a 30-30 season. So that is historical. That's something significant nonetheless. Betts will win the award, but I don't agree with that sentiment. For the NL Cy Young race, unfortunately, it looks like Jacob deGrom is going to win despite not being the best pitcher in the National League. Why do I say that? Well, Max Scherzer led the NL in strikeouts, in innings pitched, in wins, in complete games, in shutouts, in whip, and in Ks per 9 innings. Scherzer led the NL in every single one of those statistical categories. His WAR was within a half point of Jacob deGrom as well. Yet deGrom, with a 10-9 record, with less Ks and less innings, is going to win the award. deGrom did have a 1.70 ERA. I don't want to knock that by any means, but Max Scherzer, statistically, did better. And as Verducci mentioned, he said that it won't be unanimous for Jacob deGrom, but he will end up winning the award, and I agree. So, to recap my picks so far, Christian Yelich for NL MVP. For the AL, it'll be Mookie Betts. The NL Cy Young, Jacob deGrom. Going to the AL Cy Young, it's going to be Blake Snell. Snell only pitched in 180 and two-thirds innings, but you can't argue with 21 wins, an AL ERA title, an AL ERA plus title. He was first in WAR amongst AL pitchers, and he had 221 strikeouts. Justin Verlander, he puts up a good case in regards to total innings and strikeouts, but Snell's overall numbers are much better. His rate stats are much better. He will win the AL Cy Young Award. Going to the NL Rookie of the Year Award, I think it'll be Ronald Acuna. Again, I don't agree with that because I feel that Juan Soto truly helped his team more. He carried the load that Bryce Harper failed to carry all season because Harper didn't understand how to hit a baseball until August. And Juan Soto, a 19-year-old, had to carry the Nationals, and no one's giving him credit for that. And no one's talking about that, too, in regards to Bryce Harper commanding all these great offers from everyone on the free agency market. Harper couldn't hit last year and needed a 19-year-old to bail him out. Nevertheless, Acuna did do well. He turned it down in the second half, and he ended his year hitting over 290. He had 26 homers, he had 64 RBIs, and he had an OPS above 900. Ronald Acuna Jr. is going to win the NL Rookie of the Year award. And in the AL race, I feel that the voters are going to get this wrong and pick Shohei Ohtani. Now look, Ohtani did something that has not been done since the days of Babe Ruth. Don't get me wrong, he pitched and hit. Ohtani, though, was hurt most of the year. He sprained his UCL. He's going to have to get Tommy John surgery. He didn't play in many games. Meanwhile, Miguel Andujar for the Yankees hit 297, had 27 homers, 92 RBIs, played the full season. That is definitely Rookie of the Year worthy. But because of Ohtani's magic, because of the clout surrounding Ohtani, and the fact that he's from Japan, the fact that he's able to pitch and hit, the voters are just going to give it to him, even though I strongly disagree with Ohtani winning the award. So to recap, NL MVP, Christian Yelich, AL MVP, Mookie Betts, the NL Cy Young will go to Jacob deGrom, the AL Cy Young to Blake Snell, NL Rookie of the Year, Ronald Acuna Jr., and AL Rookie of the Year, Shohei Ohtani. Those are my picks for the MLB award season. And you can catch it all week. Tonight, the Rookie of the Year awards will be announced, and throughout the week, each award is going to be announced on separate days. So keep track at home, see if you can make some picks, and determine who's going to win. Those are my picks. We'll revisit those next week and see how I did. Well, that does it for us today. I hope you enjoyed our show. Again, I'm John Zaglul, host here on Sports Talk Chicago. You can find me on Twitter at John Z Sports, find me on Instagram at John Zags, on Facebook at John Zaglul, and on LinkedIn at John Zaglul. Also, make sure to tune in to SportsTalkChicago.com for articles, podcasts, more special interviews. Last Friday, I had a candid conversation with Jason Stark, writer for The Athletic and host on MLB Network. We talked about more so the free agency market, so if you haven't heard that one yet, or you have questions about free agency, I highly encourage you to listen to that podcast. It'll only take 20 minutes of your time. Very good and informative show. Please remember to tune in next Monday and every Monday at 9 a.m. to get your latest Chicago sports fix. I'd like to thank the University of Chicago, WHPK, and contributor Tom Verducci for coming on today's show, and we'll sign off with music by TMMRW. So long, everyone. We'll be right back.